In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Did medieval people really have sex in churches? What was a boy bishop? And why did women have to sit on the safe side of a church in the Middle Ages? Well, Professor Nicholas Orme, the author of a new book, Going to Church in Medieval England, will be answering all of these questions and more in the latest episode of our Everything You Wanted to Know series. That's where we put your questions on a particular topic to a leading expert. As you may have guessed, this week the subject is the medieval English church, and asking the questions was our content director, David Musgrove. First up, why was the church so important in medieval England?
That's because it's a lot more than just a way of connecting with God, which I suppose it is nowadays. It's a whole belief system, because Christianity undertakes not merely to explain one's relationship with God, but it also sets out to explain history. I mean, a lot of the Bible is history. It's also science. It's also ethics, how you should behave. So whole areas of study that we would now separate off as science or sociology or politics is at that time all within religion. That's one reason why religion is so important. A second reason is that the church is almost a half of the state. So it does a lot of things which nowadays we would look to the government to do. So it deals with education, it deals with morality, it deals with charity, things like that. And then finally, it's got a social role which it's lost nowadays, because on a Sunday morning nowadays there are lots of different things you can do. But if you imagine yourself back in a particularly a rural community in the Middle Ages, and it may be a community that's actually quite scattered, because half of England doesn't have villages. The northern and western parts of it of England are scattered communities of farms and hamlets. So the church is a wonderful place to meet, and it's also a centre where, if you want to get something going socially, you will do it. So you get companies of the maidens of the parish. These are the girls from 12 to up to marriage, the young men of the parish, the wives of the parish. So church is not just a place to meet people on a Sunday. It's actually a place where you can organise your own social group to do things. So for all these reasons, the church in the past has a huge importance that it can't possibly have today. And when people talk about somehow the church trying to get back to and recovering some state that it had in the past, that's impossible, because society has moved on. The church has to take up a different role nowadays.
Thank you. And a second search engine question that a lot of people ask is, what was the medieval church structure?
Well, there was a huge structure. And again, I suppose a modern parallel would be something like government, where you think about you think about Downing Street, the cabinet, parliament, the ministries. You think about local government. You think about all the different agencies that there are. It's all very complicated, but somehow it kind of works together. So in the case of the medieval church, you've got a hierarchy with the Pope at the top, and then archbishops, bishops, archdeacons, parish clergy. And they're all one kind of operation that's ultimately going back down to sundry worship in parish churches. You've then got all the religious orders. You've got monks, friars, nuns, Templars and Hospitallers. You've got all these organizations that are also part of the church, but are not part of the basic system. And then you've got a tremendous lay input into the church. And this is, I think, the one thing that we always underestimate about the medieval church, the extent to which it's under lay control. So bishops in England are appointed by the crown, or rather they're chosen by the crown. The crown makes a nomination, the pope appoints, but the real power lies with the crown. So the bishops are all the king's men. And then at a local level, you've only got to think of the situation of a lord of the manor and the parish church. He is the top dog locally, and everything that goes on in the parish church is going to be subject to his approval, basically. And finally, of course, there is the lay input of ordinary people. If ordinary people don't want to go to church, they don't go. That's something we underestimate. We think somehow the church had a power of control, like that, say, which Hitler or Stalin had in the 1930s. The church didn't. It did have sanctions against people going to church, but like modern law, like making people drive at 30 miles an hour or whatever, it's one thing to have the laws. It's frightful difficulty actually getting people to obey them. So It's an incredibly complicated structure, and it's different really from any modern firm like Tesco or Sainsbury's, where you can simply send out an order that the price of baked beans will go up by 2p. There's nothing like that in the Middle Ages, partly because, of course, of the communication difficulties. It takes an awfully long time to get a message from one person to the other, and that's no guarantee that that person will actually do it.
So we'll come back to the question of attendance by the populace and church control on people. We've got some good questions on that. But before we do, another good search engine question, which a lot of people want to know, is where did the church get its money? Because we have this sense, this idea that the church in the Middle Ages was fabulously rich. I don't know how far that's true or not.
Yes. Well, you see, the church is not a single body, so you can't see it, say that the church is rich any more than you can say that British society today is rich. I mean, you can say it is rich in comparison with parts of the world, but then there's enormous variations within it. So you've got at one extreme, archbishops and bishops who are on huge salaries, because, of course, in those days they had to bear the cost of their own administration. There's no such thing as a personal salary. You get a big lump of income to run your operation, basically, so it's not all yours. And then you get down at the far end, you know, the poor chaplains and curates who are helping out in the parishes, and they're on £3, £4, £5 a year, which is pretty low. That's not much above the income, or probably even below the income of a well-off peasant. So there's a huge variation there. Where did the money come from? Well, the church was endowed, again, piecemeal. Individual people over centuries gave money to the church in terms of lands, particularly to support monasteries, say, because if monks are secluded from the world, so they can't actually go out and make money, they've got to have resources that actually funnel money or food into them. And then in the parish context, the parish clergy are supported by tithes and offerings. Tithes are the most important part of their income, and that is you get one-tenth of agricultural production, the corn and the barley and the rye, and one-tenth of all the animals, the calves and the piglets and the lambs, and other lesser things as well, like honey and almost anything you, cheese or milk or whatever. And the offerings are actually much less. They are offerings of money that are made at certain times of the year or when you get baptized or married or buried and so forth. And that's what produces the income of the parish clergy. But you've only got to look, if you've ever looked at a map of English parishes, you'll see that it's an extraordinary jigsaw. There are big ones and little ones, and there are town ones and country ones, there are rich ones and poor ones. So just being a parish priest doesn't at all indicate what sort of income you will have. It can go up to, in medieval values, as much as £80 or £100 a year, which probably today would be something like £500,000. Or it can go down to this £3 or £4 a year at the other end.
Very interesting. So some wild extremes there. Now look, you've mentioned a couple of times monasteries when we were talking about the medieval church structure, for instance, and that's another search engine question, which is, what was the difference between a church and a monastery in this period?
Well, a church is any kind of religious building, and it's sometimes applied to even to small chapels. So a monastery is a church. Basically, there are two sorts of churches. There are churches that are staffed by a single person. That's a parish church, although there may be extra clergy there, but essentially the parish church has its rector or vicar who is in charge of running it. And then you have churches that are staffed by a group of people. So they include monasteries, friaries, nunneries. But you can also have churches that are staffed by a number of parish clergy. And places like Eton College or Winchester College, the Oxford and Cambridge colleges, would be examples of that. So basically, there's the church that's run by a single person, and then there's the church that contains a body of people who run it.
Now, we've got a question here from Jane Watson on Twitter, and you sort of alluded to this in an earlier answer, but perhaps you could expand a bit. How much did the church influence the lives of ordinary people? Did it affect everything they did on a spiritual basis, or was it more a set of rules to follow, rather like secular laws today?
Yes, well, the church has a spiritual influence. It wants you to attend church. It wants you to go to church for the main events of your life, your birth, your marriage, and your death. It wants you to pray. So that's one sort of influence. Nowadays, that's a voluntary influence. You do it or you don't do it as you wish. The difference in the past was that the church had rules, which it was to a certain extent able to enforce. So it required attendance on Sundays and major festivals. And it also, as I started out by saying, it has a jurisdiction over people. It can enforce its view of morality on people. There are church courts. And if you engage in extramarital sex, for example, or slander people, or engage in usury, you are summoned before the church court, not the court of the king, to have that matter dealt with. It's only in the 16th century that the crown starts to take an interest in these sorts of spheres, begins to take them over from the church. But up to the reign of Henry VIII and thereabouts, a lot of what we now regard as the sort of discipline of life is actually exercised by the church and not by local government or by the crown courts.
Right. Now then, that's the general questions out of the way. Moving on to church buildings themselves. And obviously, England and Britain more generally is full of marvellous medieval churches to go and look at. So people are interested in that. Maddie Hodges on Facebook asks, what is recognisable from medieval churches in modern churches in the UK?
Yes, well, there were about 9,500 or 10,000 medieval parish churches in England, and a vast number of those are still extant. I mean, they may have been remodeled, reshaped, but they'll have medieval material in the walls and perhaps the fittings. And then medieval churches were widely imitated in the 19th century, so that a lot of churches that you will see that look medieval are actually Victorian, but the Victorians have painstakingly tried to reproduce what a medieval church was like. In English history, you do get two different periods when the Middle Ages matters less. One is the 18th century. I mean, you think of St. Paul's Cathedral, which doesn't look quite like a medieval church. It looks like something much more classical. And in the present day, again, if you thought of Coventry Cathedral, for example, you're looking at something that is rather different as a building. But they still will always follow the same template, so that basically they're in two different sections. You've got a chancel or a choir, which is where services happen. And then to the west of that, you have a nave, which is where people stand or sit to watch what is going on. And then you have an altar up at the east end and a font at the west end and a porch on the outside. So every church will have certain features, even if it's built today, which actually go back to the Middle Ages.
So were they following a sort of a standard template then in when they were building them?
That's right. Yes, you always have to have a chancel and a nave. Otherwise, it will vary a lot depending on what you can afford. And this basic two cell structure, you can add to. You can put out wings, which we call transepts. You can widen the church and put corridors down the sides, which we call aisles. You can build on chapels. You can put up a tower, or more than one tower if you want to. So you can elaborate the plan, but it always comes down essentially to this two unit. It comes down to these two units of chancel and nave. And if you go into a tiny chapel in the countryside, you will still see the remains of the same thing. You have an area for worship and an area for watching.
And trying to drill into Maddie's question a bit more specifically, is there anything that's sort of quintessentially medieval in terms of features in these churches that would enable you to say this is the standout medieval feature? So to enable you to say, well, this isn't a later Victorian addition or anything like that?
Well, the Victorians were very good at imitating the Middle Ages, actually. The only thing they tended to differ about was which bit of medieval architecture they should follow. Shall we do it in the 13th century style or the 14th century style or the 15th century style? So you get different versions of it. But it will often be quite difficult to distinguish a Victorian church from a medieval church unless you're a bit of an expert. And I remember once showing a primary school round my local church, and the headmaster was amazed when I told him it was built in 1852. He just always assumed it went back to about 1352.
Here's a good question that a lot of people ask on search engines, which is, were medieval churches colourful?
Well, they were up to a point. So they wanted Christ to have a nice place of worship. So the altar, which is at the east end of the church, will have a hanging of coloured fabric on it. Any other altars will have similar hangings. And the clergy for the major services will appear in very nice vestments. But of course, that depends on what you can afford. And when we say very nice, yes, you're talking about Canterbury Cathedral or the King's Chapel at Windsor. But if you're talking about some very poor place up in the hills, the vestments and the altar cloths may be rather shabby and moth-eaten because we can't afford new ones, or we're just not bothered about them. Again, you can have very nice window glass in churches, coloured window glasses, and we've got some wonderful examples of that at Canterbury Cathedral, and some of our parish churches have it as well. But a lot of churches will not be able to afford that. And it's often thought that all medieval churches were painted up inside, that their walls were decorated. Well, they were up to a point. Sometimes the decoration will actually be quite simple. It will be simply be imitation brickwork on plaster or stenciled patterns. To get really good wall paintings, well, there are a number, and then there were a lot more in the past, but it doesn't follow that every church had them. And we've got plenty of complaints about bad church interiors. So don't imagine that this was a wonderful golden age of beauty. It was in some places, and there were also very beautiful images of Virgin Mary and saints and so on. But you also hear about images that have been scratched or have lost bits, which need repainting. Because in the end, all church history comes down to human nature. And human nature covers a vast range of enthusiasm and negligence, basically. So you'll get some churches that were very nicely appointed and looked after, and you'll get others that weren't.
So the Exeter Cathedral, the magnificent building there, and Exeter being the university that you taught at and I studied at, and if you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the west front of that has been shown to be like a beautiful polychromatic display where they painted all the figures that stand outside at the front of the cathedral. Is that not right? And is that a is that like a not a particularly common sort of feature?
No, that's perfectly right, and a lot of what we now see in churches, particularly monuments, actually, when you see these knights and ladies recumbent on tombs, we see them just as stone, but they would originally have been painted. They were meant to look realistic. But, you know, things wear out. And I'm sure the west front of Exeter Cathedral, with all these beautifully painted statues, when it was finished in about 1350, it must have looked very nice indeed. Within 30 years or so, it was probably beginning a bit grubby, and there were lichens and moss growing and so on. And then it depends on somebody having the effort and the money to actually put it back again.
Now, this is a great question, which I'd love to know the answer to. Another search engine question. What did medieval churches smell like?
A mixture of damp, candle, smoke and incense.
Would it have been quite a heady mix? Would you, when you went in, would it have been quite a unique sort of smell, do you think?
Well, if you'd just been in after a service, you'd smell the incense. If you went in a couple of days later, you wouldn't to the same extent. I think you would have smelt the damp. And of course, if you'd been in there at a well-attended service, you'd have smelt humanity.
Now, I'm just thinking, this is a question which wasn't in the list, but occurs to me now. We talked about what churches look like and smelt like. So to complete the sensory experience, what did they sound like? Are you able to answer that?
They certainly understood principles of sound, and I think it's been shown that certain churches are designed in order to project sound or not to absorb sound. But the sound that you get, again, it will depend on the church. Wealthy churches with a lot of clergy and choirs will do a lot of elaborate music. The basic music is plain song, which is sung in unison. The more elaborate music, which comes in particularly in the 15th century, is called polyphony, and that's music in different parts. And you'll get that in the really top-rate churches and cathedrals and royal chapels. In parish churches, the music will be much more basic. And it won't be so well performed. It may be only one priest doing his plain song, and therefore you're in his hands entirely. There's nobody else to help. So again, just as I've said that There's a huge difference in sizes of churches, layout of churches, decoration of churches. Music in churches will vary enormously as well.
So do you imagine when you go into some of these larger churches or even smaller parish churches, they all have speaker systems, don't they, going around the pillars and stuff, and they have modern audio systems there, which are there for a reason so that people can hear. Do you think that people would have been able to properly hear services in the past when clearly they didn't have those sorts of facilities?
No, they are dependent on the carrying power of the human voice. And in a large church, if you're at the back of the congregation, you're not going to hear so well. One thing that we ought to discuss at some point is that where you sit in church is not where you would like to sit. It's where you ought to sit. And so leaders of society are up at the East End, so they can hear well. And the further back the church you go towards the West, the lower the social rank. So it's the servants and possibly the children who are right at the back and will hear least well. You've also got the interesting point that in the Mass, which is the principal Sunday service, the most solemn part of the Mass is not spoken. This is the prayer of consecration, or the canon as it's known, and it is said by the priest in a very low, inaudible voice because it is so holy. So at that point, the church suddenly becomes silent. It won't be entirely silent because there'll be somehow a movement from the congregation. There'll be these sort of echoing sounds that you get in concerts. There'll be a few people mumbling prayers and so forth. But medieval worship is not just about sound. It is also about silence.
Now, this leads us nicely into our next section, which is about kind of the church experience. You've talked about this one a little bit, and this is a big question. Search engine question, did medieval peasants go to church?
Well, did anybody in the Middle Ages go to church? And the answer is yes and no. You are expected to go to church. And that means not on weekdays, because you have to work, but Sundays and festivals. And there are actually about 40 or 50 important festivals during the year. So on about 90 days of the year, you are expected to be in church at least on the morning for the morning service. But who is going to make you go? There were inducements to go, obviously, in that there are inducements to go. There are pious people who want to go to church. There are people who want to go to church to socialise. But there are also people who would much rather stay at home and either lie in bed or actually get on with some work. If you've got a field that's coming up for reaping or whatever, that's what you want to do. If you're a shoemaker who's been making shoes all the week, Sunday is a wonderful place to go off and sell them. Go to other churches, because that's a great gathering place for people, and sell your shoes. And the church has this problem. It can't, in the end, impose 100% attendance. It has to recognise that certain people needn't be in church. So shepherds are not expected to be in church. Fishermen are not expected to be there, because they've got to be out. If it's the right day, they've got to be out getting the herring in. Servants. A bit equivocal about servants. I mean, the rich want to go home after church and have their dinner. Who's making the dinner? So there has to be a bit of an exception for servants. And in the end, actually making somebody go to church is a difficult business. The priest can tell them off. He can refuse to hear their confession or give them communion at Easter. He can report them to the church court. But it's all terribly cumbersome. Making people go to church is like making people clear up after their dog mess. You can have the rule, you can have the bins there, but it's actually very, very difficult to do it. And if you find somebody who's doing it, then it's a long process actually to enforce it, to fine them or whatever. And so there's always going to be a proportion of people in the parish who don't often go to church. I don't think you get away with going never, but you could get away with it to a certain extent. After all, you could always say it wasn't feeling very well. And that would cover quite a lot of things. And I think in the end, the people who actually get called to the church court and get fined or whatever, they're people who are unpopular in the community anyway. Because if you're not going to church, it's quite likely you're upsetting people in other ways. You're being antisocial. And in the end, everybody says, yeah, we had enough of this. Send them to the church court and get them sorted out. But it was much too difficult a process to make sure that 100% of people were there. I wouldn't like to put a number on how many there were on a particular Sunday. Easter is absolutely compulsory for adults. And so almost everybody is there then. I think Christmas and Pentecost or Whitsuntide, they're also compulsory, but they're not everybody there for those. And then once you go down to ordinary Sundays, it's a lot less. You've also got to remember that children are not required to go to church, and children are at 1/3 of the population.
Okay, right. You've answered a couple of other questions there as well. So you answered Inez Prohensa's question about whether people were forced to attend. So that's good. I think you've said that wasn't necessarily the case. And then the search engine question, when did medieval churches church services happen? You've answered that. But there was a subsidiary bit to that, which is how long did services last for? Are you able to tell us how long a church service would have gone on for?
Yes, as far as parish churches are concerned, and monasteries are different. As far as parish churches are concerned, there are two services every day, Matins and Evensong. Matins is at about 7 o'clock in the morning. It's soon after daybreak, and it's going to last for about an hour and a half. And then in the afternoon, there is Evensong, which is going to happen at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and is going to go on until about 4:30. So those are the two services that the clergy have to do every day, irrespective of whether anybody is at them. They have to go into church, they have to say those prayers through every day. Some people will be there. On a weekday, of course, it will only be the most pious or the most leisured who can take a bit of time off to do it. The other service, which you will always have on a Sunday or a festival day, and in many churches you'll have it every day, is Mass. That will happen after Matins, probably about 9, and will last for an hour. So in a normal church, there's about 4 hours of worship happening every day. But you don't necessarily have to go to all of those. On a Sunday, you are recommended to go to all of them. But even pious people, I think, didn't necessarily do that.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Churches are places for sex, as are churchyards. I mean, they are. You see, going to church is an acceptable way of leaving home. So if you want to meet up with a lover, going to church, particularly on a weekday, is a good way of meeting up. And if you want a very quiet place, a churchyard, particularly at night, it also has its attractions.
Right. Now, here's another question, which we've sort of talked around a bit, but perhaps you can try and give a specific answer. And this is from Ruth Wilson on Twitter, who wants to know, what was the experience of church going like for an ordinary person? Were they seated or standing? Did they join in the response? Did they sing? or did they just listen? So you've talked about this a little bit in terms of where people sat, but can you give us a sense about what it was actually like to be in a medieval church service?
Yes. Well, seating, as far as we can see, comes in the 14th and 15th centuries. We don't really know that much about churches, how they were used before 1300. But the likelihood is that there weren't very many seats, except for the nobility and gentry who would be up in the choir of or chancel of the church with the clergy. That other people would not have had seats unless they brought their own. You could bring a stool or something to sit on, but that you're probably dealing up to, say, 1350 with a standing congregation or a congregation that kneels at the most important point, which in the Mass is when you consecrate the bread and wine of the Eucharist and the priest holds it up to be venerated, and you are supposed to kneel or at least bow and genuflect when that happens. During the 14th century, it seems that seating becomes more and more common. What is happening is that the upper orders of society have got their seats at the best part of the church, the East End, and the rest of society is wanting to imitate this, and it's gradually going down. So it's, first of all, it'd be the wealthy farmers who want seats. And then, because, as I've already explained, social differentiation is so important, in the end, the parish church authorities are really obliged to put in general seating. You can't have everybody turning up with a seat or putting their own seat in. You've got to actually grade it so that, as I said, the important are at the front of the church, the less important are at the back of the church. So by the 15th century, it's becoming very common for a church to have what we often see nowadays are a whole rows of pews or forms. And then they will be allocated by the church wardens, who are the lay officers who actually run the parish church. You will be allocated a seat, and that is the seat in which you have to sit. You don't just go and sit in anybody's seat. As to the experience in a service, well, the services are in Latin. And they are said or said and sung in the chancel, which has got a big screen between it and the nave. So the service is quite a long way away from you. You are not expected, as you are in a modern church, to follow the service, to say responses. That's done by the parish clerk. You are expected to watch the service almost like we do when we go to a concert. We're part of the experience. We listen to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and we're part of the experience, but we're not playing it. And that's what it's like in a medieval church. So the performers are up in the chancel. You're listening and watching. You're being devout. You're spiritually with it. You may have a rosary and you say your basic prayers with your clicking off your beads, or you've got a prayer book with you if you're literate and you're reading that. Not the same book as the clergy are using, a different book. So you've got this murmur of voices, subdued murmur of voices that you would have got in the nave alongside the service that is in the chancel. Now, the one thing that people have not previously understood is that there is quite a lot of English in the Latin services. And this has probably always been the case, but it's becoming particularly clear by the 15th century. So there are three or four points in the service when English is used. At the beginning of the service, everybody is sprinkled with holy water and is treated to an English verse which encourages them to give their attention to the service. In the middle of the service, you get announcements, you get prayers for the king, for the crops, for the for individual people. You get a bit of a sermon if you're lucky. And then at the end of the service, you get some more English and you get given a piece of bread, because you don't receive the communion, bread and wine, at all, except that you get the bread at Easter, not the wine. But on a normal Sunday, when the Mass is over, the priest blesses a loaf of bread, which is provided by each family in the parish in turn, and it's broken up into little bits. And there's some English words to accompany this, and then you get your bit, and that's effectively your communion. So it's not at all like a modern church experience. You are not expected to take part in the words. You're expected to do your own thing. And it was quite a change, and an unwelcome change for some people at the Reformation, when the Church of England suddenly required people to take part in the service. And there's a very amusing thing I came across when Queen Mary became Queen in 1553, and we briefly went back to Catholicism. Somebody said, "Hey, this is great. Now when I go to church, I can do my own thing. I don't have to take part in the service."
So you've sort of answered this next question as well, and particularly when you're talking about the elements of English vernacular in the services. But a popular search engine query is, did medieval people actually understand what was going on in these church services?
Well, they would have understood through long familiarity with the service. Obviously, the Mass is. Has basically the same form every time. So if you've been there, as you should be, 52 times a year from the age of 14, you're going to know the service pretty well. And the priest should have explained the salient points of it in his sermons. Medieval parish clergy didn't do much preaching. They were told that four times a year they ought to explain basic things to the congregation, and that's often as much as people got. So they it would have been explained what was happening at the beginning and why this or that action or prayer was important, and so on. That they would have known all this simply by experience. But otherwise, no. They're as I've said, they're not expected to take part in the service. They're expected to be there, to be devout, and to follow it, and that it will somehow give them spiritual cleansing and power by being present at it. That you don't need to be intellectually involved with it. To go back to my Beethoven analogy, I mean, I don't know the first thing about what he's doing with his notes, but I just get the feel of power or whatever it is from the music. And that's what it was like to be in a medieval service.
Now, you've already spoken about this next question a couple of times, but I wonder if you might expand on it slightly. This is from Jenny Nichols on Twitter, who wants to know about children in church. Her question was, did kids go to the same service for the same length of time, or did they have the equivalent of a Sunday school type thing? Now, you've already said that children weren't required to go to church. So did they go, or were there other facilities and provisions made for them?
Well, we know that small children were often taken to church because they couldn't be safely left at home. And we do have some examples of accidents that happened when parents left small children at home, possibly in the care of an elder sibling, and trouble happened. So small children were often taken to church, and we actually get complaints about this. Adults in congregations are often very unforgiving about children in church and their restlessness or the noise they make, and that was the case in the 15th and 16th centuries as well. You will also get children going to church, I think, because it's something that's going on. Again, going back to the countryside situation, not a lot is going on. And particularly on a Sunday morning, most people are in church anyway. So there's nothing going on in the smithy or the inn or attract your attention there. So children will turn up, and sometimes they are mischievous. I mean, we've got examples of children being a nuisance in church or coming in and messing around with things. But no, there is absolutely no concept of a children's service except once or twice a year. And this is the boy bishop service, which happens either on St. Nicholas Day, which is the 6th of December, or on the Holy Innocents Day, which is the 28th of December, or sometimes on both occasions. And on one or both of those days, you have a boy leading the services in church, and he is dressed up like a bishop with a little bishop's hat or mitre on and a bishop's staff, and he presides over the service and he gives a blessing, and he has an entourage of other children, probably boys actually rather than girls. Girls get a rather poor look in medieval church services. And then there's a lot of out-of-church activity. There's then they go round the village or the town begging, essentially, for food and money. And in some places, it's quite elaborate. In York, which is our northern Archbishop's Cathedral, the boys there went on horseback out into Yorkshire for as much as a week, and they stayed at monasteries and they stayed at manor houses and they were feasted and they came back with a considerable amount of money. I mean, 10 or 20 pounds, which they then divided up among themselves. But that's the high end of the thing. The parish boy bishops, I think, would have been lucky if they'd got much more than a few apples or a half pint of ale as they went round the parish. But no, there's nothing like a Sunday school. That begins to come in at the Reformation in 1549. The English prayer book of 1549 says that the parish priest must hold a class in church in the afternoons. There was a new thing called the catechism, which you had to learn, which explained the Lord's Prayer and the Ten Commandments and the Creed, and you had to be word perfect in that. But that's a new thing that comes in, and Sunday schools are even later than that. They're really 18th, 19th centuries.
Just a couple more. You talked about girls in church not having that much of a role. There's a question here on Google, which is, were men and women separated in church services?
This is a very interesting question, and it's actually very hard to answer. And I think sometimes they were and sometimes they weren't. It appears that wealthy people were not separated, because we hear of nobility and gentry, merchants and their wives sitting together. And as I've previously explained, this would be in the eastern part of the church. They'll get into the chancel or choir of the church, or they'll get into side chapels and they'll be there. The rest of the congregation may well have been separated, but it's probably varied locally. There are certainly examples of churches where they place the women and the men separately. Women usually on the north side of the church, men on the south side. There's a reason for that, which I could go into explaining if necessary. But equally, there are other customs. There is a custom that particular seats shall be tied to particular properties, so that if you live in Willowbrook Farm, as it were, that's the seat that you have to sit in, and then the man and the wife and the children will all sit in that seat. So it's one of these things that obviously varied locally.
You'd better explain that point you just mentioned that you could expand on about the north side.
Yes. The north side of the church is the safe side of the church, and the south side of the church is the unsafe side of the church. Now, you have to imagine what a medieval church looked like inside. Between the chancel at the east end and the nave at the west end, you've got this screen, which is about 12 feet high and is open windows, not glazed, so that you can get the sound through from the chancel, but you can't actually get into the chancel. Above the screen, you have the rood loft, which is a kind of gallery. In the middle of the rood loft, you have the rood, which is Christ on the cross. So he is facing west, and on his right-hand side is the Virgin Mary, and on his left-hand side is St. John the Evangelist. So the right-hand side is the safe side. That's the side of the Virgin Mary. It's the side of the saved. If you've ever seen these pictures of the Last Judgment, the figures on the north side of Christ are all going up to heaven, and the figures on the south side are going down to hell. Now, the women have to be on the safe side because they're more open to temptation than men are, so is the view. The men are rather sturdier at standing up for to evil, so say. So they are on the dangerous side.
Glad I pushed you on that. Fascinating.
I don't expect anybody who's listening to that to agree with it.
No, of course. Another really big search engine question is, did medieval people go to confession in churches? And if so, how did that work? What did that look like?
Yes, that's another very interesting question I've been investigating. Everybody from 1215 onwards in the Catholic Church is required to go to confession once a year. And the time to go to confession was in Lent. Lent is, roughly speaking, the 6 weeks before Easter in March and early April. And you have to go to church for confession. You're not confessed in your own home. And it was a considerable burden for the clergy to do this because, as I've explained, they had their morning and afternoon services to do. So they've only got a restricted window of time between 10 and 3 in which to do this. And they've also got to have their dinner, their main meal in that bit of time as well. And if you've got a parish of average size, you're probably going to have about 250 adults. And that's actually quite a lot of people to do an annual confession with. How long are you going to spend? If you really go through everything that one is supposed to believe and ask if they believe it, and go through everything that one is supposed to have done and not to have done, and go through all that, you could be there for a couple of hours. And clearly that wasn't possible. I think the average Lenten confession must have taken about 15 or 20 minutes. It must have been a pretty quick trot through the subject. Of course, pious people went to confession more often, but the only time that you had to go to confession was in Lent on this occasion. And then the other thing that you had to do at the end of Lent was to take your annual communion on Easter Sunday. So these are the two things that the church insists on for all adults: confession once a year, followed by communion once a year. But communion, you only got on Easter Sunday. You don't get it any other time of the year normally. And when you get it, you only receive the consecrated bread. So a little wafer, baked wafer of bread, and that's put straight into your mouth. So you can't do anything that you shouldn't do with it. You were then given a drink of unconsecrated wine. They can't give you consecrated wine because the belief is that in the Mass, the bread and the wine become, each of them becomes, the body and blood of Christ. And in a congregation where you've got people of all kinds, and you may even have the village idiot there, you can't afford to have somebody slobbering Christ's blood all over themselves or all over the floor. It's just not possible. The bread is relatively easy. Even then, they have to guard against crumbs. So when you receive the bread, two people hold a towel in front of your chin, and then the wafer is popped in, and that stops any bits of Christ getting on the floor. But the wine is too big a problem. So you're given unconsecrated wine just to wash the wafer down, and that's your Easter communion. And those are the two things that you have to have every year, confession and communion.
So just on the final part on the confession then, were there confession booths? Are they a feature of churches, or was it?
No, confession booths were an invention of the Catholic Church in the 16th century. Medieval people were worried a lot about confession. Remember that the clergy were all celibate, and they were worried about untoward things going on between a priest and a woman, particularly. So confession has to happen in church, in a part of the church that is public. So it's either done in the nave of the church or just inside the screen so that it can be visible. The person who is confessing kneels, but doesn't look directly at the priest. The priest is sitting in a chair. He pulls his hood over his head so that he can't be seen particularly. And he's told not to look directly at the person confessing. And then the confession takes place. But they didn't have booths in which to do it until much later. And there are examples of priests trying to seduce women during confession, actually. So it's not a ridiculous idea. It sometimes happened. Come into the vestry and I'll do it there. And then, you know, things began to happen.
How do we know about that? Is that recorded in church courts?
Yes, some clergy are brought up in church courts for that purpose. And churches are places for sex, as are churchyards. I mean, they are. You see, going to church is an acceptable way of leaving home. So, if you want to leave to meet up with a lover, going to church, particularly on a weekday, is a good way of meeting up. And if you want a very quiet place, a churchyard, particularly at night, it also has its attractions.
So hang on, I'm gonna have to go. So you said church is a place for sex. So people were going into churches and having sex. How do we know that?
Well, there's a delightful book for the education of women that was written by a French knight in about 1380, and it's actually got a warning about having sex in church, and it tells the story of a man and a woman who did so under the altar. And they got stuck together and they couldn't be disentangled until the whole congregation had turned up and prayed for them. So they got, you know, public humiliation. So if somebody is actually putting that in a book for the education of young women, I think we can reasonably expect that it might have happened.
Gosh, well, that's unexpected. Right, last one, I think, which is a nice one to finish on, from Anna Walsh on Twitter. And Anna would like to know how widespread atheism was, or non-church attendance. And we talked about church attendance just a little bit now, but I suppose the wider point of atheism versus piety, what can you say about that? How pious were medieval people?
Well, atheism and piety, I suppose, are slightly different. I don't think there were many people who would have openly said they did not believe in the existence of a God. There weren't books in circulation that would have said that you could have appealed to. So if you had said it, everybody would have said, well, you're just mistaken or mad. And it would have come up when you next went to confession. But I think there was plenty of popular skepticism around. And I think that's something that historians have tended to underestimate. We haven't actually talked about heresy, but England did not have much in the way of heresy until the 1380s, when an Oxford scholar called John Wycliffe began actually to challenge, in intellectual terms, a lot of the beliefs and rules of the church. And he attracted followers who became known as the Lollards, who believed that you should read the Bible in English, that you should live a rather puritanical form of life, that you should not engage in what they called superstitions like pilgrimages or the veneration of images and so on. And it's widely recognised that Lollards were a small minority of the population, I think. And so historians have tended to say, OK, everybody else was Orthodox. I don't believe that. I believe that there was an awful lot of scepticism about. It must have been very hard to believe a lot of the church's dogmas. For example, the fact that the priest at Mass has consecrated this wafer and this tiny chalice of wine, and they are now the body and blood of Christ. But look, they go on looking like bread and wine. So how can this be? The church is insisting on it. You get into trouble if you disbelieve it. But it's very hard to believe. And we've got evidence that people found that hard to believe, that they speculated about things like the Virgin Mary. Did she have other children? This is something the Bible is rather actually mysterious about, isn't it? We hear of James, the brother of the Lord. The church said, no, Mary was a virgin. She married an elderly man, Joseph. But look here, were there other children? These are things the church didn't really like to get involved with, but people wondered about them. Was it really right for God to chuck Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden? We hear, one writer says, I've heard people discussing this. So there was scepticism around, and people did not believe everything they were told, just as people didn't go to church all the time as they were meant to do. And there's this huge lay influence, I think, that we are constantly undervalue about medieval religion or religion in any period. We think that it's all being stage managed by clergy, and that everybody is having to go along with that, unless they totally turn their backs on it, which they can do nowadays. But in fact, there's a tremendous amount of lay influence on what the clergy do. I'll give you another example of this. What happens if a baby dies before it's been baptized? Now, according to the official church dogma, it can't go to heaven. But then it hasn't sinned, so it can't go to hell. So it has to go to a place called limbo, which is on the edge of hell. And its punishment is not being burnt in fire or anything, but by the knowledge that it can never get to heaven. Well, that's all a terribly bleak way of looking at the death of a newborn baby, which is terribly traumatic for parents. And people didn't go along with that. You get scholars saying, well, there may be a way around this. Jesus talked about the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Suppose the Holy Spirit baptizes every new child, then it will go to heaven. Officially, this is not church dogma, but it's what some theologians are saying. And what happens when dad is told by the parish priest, you can't bury your newborn dead baby in the churchyard because it's not baptized? Dad goes along at night with a spade and he puts it in. And we know that that happened.
Nicholas, this is absolutely fascinating. It feels like we've only really touched the surface of what we could have talked about here, but we've gone through most of the questions that we had in from our audience. Obviously, you've got loads more material in your book, Going to Church in Medieval England. I suppose, just a final point, is there anything that you would like people who aren't experts in the medieval church to know about? Any sort of final things, that any last points that you'd like to make that we should be on top of?
Well, my belief is that human nature is unchanging. So the people of the medieval church were us. I mean, clearly they did not know a lot that we know, and they did not have a lot that we have. But when you're trying to make the past very simple, it can't be simple. So people can't be all pious. People can't be all church-going. Churches can't all be neat and clean and well-organized. There's always going to be a range because human nature is like that. And what I hope people will do with histories is not only enjoy the difference of the past, because the difference of the past is interesting, how they managed to work in their world, in their very different world, but also to recognize how similar people in the past were to people today.
That was Professor Nicholas Orme. His book, Going to Church in Medieval England, will be published by Yale on the 27th of July. As always, you can find a wealth of more material on the medieval world on our website. Just go to historyextra.com/medieval. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. We'll be back tomorrow when Alex von Tunzelmann will be giving her thoughts on the great historical statue debate.